From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This is Nathan Baca.
I'm opening up a bag right now, since I have them inside this plastic baggie. I'm holding one right now. It says CM Scatshell, OC.
Nathan is an investigative reporter for the Washington television station WUSA 9. And earlier this month, he was tear gassed.
To be used by trained law enforcement, correctional or military personnel, do not use for operations after 5 years from data manufacture. Produced by the Safariland Group, Casper, Wyoming, part number 6170.
On June 1st, he was in Lafayette Square reporting on a major protest near the White House. That evening, President Trump walked to St. John's Episcopal Church for a photo op. And just before 7 p.m., law enforcement officers from at least three agencies cleared protesters from the area for the president's walk. Nathan picked up the canisters that had been fired at protesters by the police.
You know what it looks like? It looks like a shotgun shell, a very big silver metal shotgun shell. When you look on the inside, you see it's scored and scorched because something was launched there with some powder and it exploded out.
Soldiers cannot use tear gas on the battlefield, but domestic law enforcement can use it on American streets. Why? Well, that is the question we are exploring this hour. First, here's what happened to Nathan.
We got there just around 5:30, and everything seemed peaceful. It was a very diverse and energized group. We saw mothers and fathers with their children there. We saw middle-aged folks. We saw people who probably, I wouldn't be surprised, maybe had been there during the 1960s and some of the civil rights movement. People chanting, "Whose streets are streets?" Chanting the name of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others who had been killed in police brutality. This would have been right around 6 o'clock, and we found ourselves right on the fence line of Lafayette Square Park. We saw movements of police officers getting really close to the fence and getting to the fence line. And that made people nervous because they didn't know why they were advancing to the fence line just after 6 o'clock. Because everybody had known through the news coverage that 7 p.m. was going to be the curfew time. I heard a loudspeaker coming from the police side on Lafayette Square Park. The first time, I just couldn't make out what it was. It was garbled. Then I heard it again. A few minutes later, right around 6:15, one of our other photographers, Kurt Brooks, he thought, "I think they might be issuing a disperse order." And then, around 6:30, we heard the first flashbang, that pop. Sure enough, you see that human wave of people starting to scatter. They were afraid about what was happening. The first push was mostly about shock and awe. Stinger ball grenades and a lot of popping, banging. And that was the first wave. And then people started to kind of collect themselves right alongside the intersection of Vation 17. At that point, would have been around 6:35, 6:40. We started to notice these gas canisters start to get rolled our way. I remember running through the smoke from those canisters, and it was like this yellowish green color. And I remember seeing this line of police just march south, almost like some Civil War battle line, just marching south, firing off these canisters. And they were launching them at distance. I won't forget that because they were like lobbying them, not rolling them. They were being fired as they were marching south on 17th, south of H Street, past Pennsylvania Avenue. I cried like I hadn't experienced before. It certainly wasn't an emotional cry. It was the cry of there's something burning your eyes and your tear ducts just won't stop. Becca, our photojournalist, she was just coughing quite a bit. We're running on adrenaline because we're all running south on 17th Street, south of H Street, and trying to get to safety because our security guard was just trying to pull us across the side of the street to avoid, as best we could, these gas canisters that are starting to keep on rolling past us. And you see in our video, as we're running, we change direction quickly to the right because we see a canister that is smoking this sort of yellowish-greenish tint rolling two people in front of us at our feet.
We're going to move to the right, across the street. Let's go.
We just watched it. We were We were still going live on our air on WSA9.
Mounted police are taking over this section of 8th Street as they're telling everybody to move back, but it's happening so quickly that people are basically tripping and collapsing.
And then we rounded the corner again after a little bit because I was hearing in my earpiece that the president was at the Rose Garden. Then we started to hear in the earpiece that president is walking across to the Episcopal Church, just where we were. The four of us, myself, photojournalist Becca Nyer, sports anchor Darren Hayes, and our security guard, John, we were all just there at that intersection, and we started to take notice of the things that were on the ground, on the street, and we noticed these canisters or the remnants of this stinger ball grenade, and we just started to pick them up. Darren and I, we took those canisters and we split them up amongst each other. And I remembered, wait a minute, his looked slightly different. His had different markings on it. Mine was orange, his was light blue. And so I called him up and I said, I need you to show me, take a picture, what your canister looks like. And he did, and it was exactly how I remembered it. It was light blue and it said CS gas. I was like, that right there is further evidence that one of the agencies that cleared Lafayette Park that Monday used artificial tear gas, a gas that is something that everybody was denying was used, but it was used, and there was the evidence of it. When I view the video of what happened and still hear those screams of people confused, shocked, some cases physically hurt, you hear that and it takes you back to that moment. And whereas one could be thankful that most people escaped lasting injury, there may be a concussion here, burns and injuries there, it still was so shocking to all witness that as a communal group that it shakes one's understanding of what it is to be a citizen.
That's Nathan Baca. He's an investigative reporter at WUSA 9 in Washington, D.C. So why can domestic law enforcement use tear gas on citizens when it's banned as a weapon of war? That is the question we want to explore this hour. And joining us to help us do that is Anna Feigenbaum, author of the book Tear Gas, From the Battlefields of World War I to the Streets of Today. She's also an associate professor of communication and digital media at Bournemouth University's Talbot campus in southern England, and she joins us from Poole, England. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first and foremost, I just want to pick up where Nathan left off. What we do know is that in the days after that June 1st protest and police action, all of the law enforcement agencies, U.S. law enforcement agencies involved there, including the U.S. Park Service Police, the Bureau of Prisons, the Secret Service, et cetera, they all denied using tear gas on the protesters. In subsequent days, part of those denials were walked back. For example, a spokesperson for the U.S. Park Service Police said, I'm not going to say that pepper balls don't irritate you. I'm not saying it's not a tear gas, but I'm just saying that we use pepper balls that shoot a powder. So first of all, help us understand, is there a meaningful difference between the types of materials that law enforcement use that are broadly called tear gas?
So tear gas is an umbrella term, and it's really just a kind of euphemism for what is a toxic chemical agent. And over time, we've had different kinds of these toxic chemical agents developed. So currently, we use kind of what generally gets seen as two sets. One, PAVA and OC, which more frequently get called pepper sprays. However, that is misleading because they can be a powder, just as in that case. Then we have our what usually get called tear gases, which are CS, less often CR, and CN, also less often. CS is really the widely used one. that too can be distributed as a powder or as an aerosol. And we normally have CS with the smoke. That is what makes it look like gas, but that's not necessarily exclusive. So from a kind of chemical composition side of things, they can actually be dispersed and deployed in more or less similar ways. In terms of if you're the person that's being hit by these things, there's not going to be a huge difference on which chemical it is that has been used. There'll be a difference whether you're sprayed in the face or whether you're in big clouds of gas or whether, like with those sting ball grenades, you're having pellets shot at you, or with pepper balls, you're having pellets shot at you as well as having the gas. So the ways in which you're going to be hit by something is going to matter more if you're the person being hit than the actual composition of those different chemicals.
I see. Okay. So the delivery mechanism you're talking about there. I'm seeing here that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention call CN and CS gases the most common, quote unquote, most common forms of tear gas. And as you heard Nathan describe there, they were picking up canisters that were labeled as such right off the street in Washington. So which one of these, or are all of these, the ones that are banned for use by soldiers in war?
So all of those would be classified as chemical agents that are banned in the use of war. And there's a couple important stipulations that are why we have that distinction, particularly in the context of the United States. So for the United States, what makes that justification of those distinctions is that they say it's banned in war for offensive purposes. So it shouldn't be used as a weapon in the way that you would go in and you would fire missiles. It shouldn't be used in that way offensively.
Okay, Anna, hang on for just a second, because we do have to take a quick break, and I'll let you pick up that thought on the nuances here when we get back. So we are talking this hour about the story of tear gas and why it's allowed to be used by domestic law enforcement in the United States. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the story of tear gas. And I'm joined today by Anna Feigenbaum. She's Associate Professor in Communication and Digital Media and Deputy Head of the Communication and Journalism Department at Bournemouth University's Talbot Campus in southern England. She's author of Tear Gas, From the Battlefields of World War I to the Streets of Today. And Anna, you were talking about some of the nuances around the prohibitions of the use of tear gas as a weapon of war. But so continue on what you were saying.
Yeah, so these two reasons for why we have this distinction, and one is this offensive-defensive. So the idea was that they shouldn't be used offensively in war, and that goes back to the First World War. So the idea that chemical weapons were being used offensively to attack people to get them out of the trenches. So they want to prohibit those kinds of uses of these chemical agents because of their relation to chemical weaponry. The other stipulation that makes this distinction that allows for riot control agents or tear gases to be used against civilians is how much toxin is in them. So how much, what the kind of toxic chemical component is. So if it's under a particular threshold, then it's deemed less lethal enough to allow it for use on civilians. And so those two things are really important, particularly when we're thinking about the history of this legislation and any future legislation that might arise.
So you're saying, just so I understand clearly, you're saying that even in a battlefield war scenario, there are situations in which it can still be used. Essentially, that's what it boils down to.
According to policy researchers, the U.S. maintains that RCAs can legitimately be used for a range of non-offensive actions by military forces present in certain areas of armed conflict. But those need to be what they classify as defensive uses rather than offensive uses.
Okay, so the U.S. maintains that. Understood.
Yes.
Now, but I'm seeing here that, for example, people are pointing to the Chemical Weapons Convention, which says, there's a PolitiFact article, for example. I'm hoping you can help us understand the details here, that says each state party undertakes not to use riot control agents as a method of warfare. And then they define the riot control agents as any chemical not listed in a schedule, which can produce rapidly in humans sensory irritation and disabling physical effects. So how does the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1993 fold into here? Or is that what you were referencing?
That is what I'm referencing. Okay. So the U.S. has its own interpretation of what a method of warfare is. So that's where the offensive-defensive distinction becomes important. And now I'm not a policy expert, but I work with a lot of policy experts. So this is my understanding of where we're at with this. So what is an issue on politically is that if we start to see, as there is a very good case for right now, the use of tear gases by law enforcement officials offensively, that then questions that exception to use that permits law enforcement to use it.
Uh-huh.
And likewise, if we see too much of the toxin, too much of what makes it no longer non-lethal, so too much of what would make it more lethal, what we might think of as a too big dose, then we also get into issues around what allows it to be permitted and separated out from other forms of chemical warfare.
I see. But isn't this interesting, though, that within the same Chemical Warfare's convention, you're talking about the United States building in exceptions to this? I mean, I'm seeing here, it says what you're saying clearly. It says, quote, law enforcement, including domestic riot control purposes, is not prohibited. Is that unusual in terms of these kinds of agreements?
So these kinds of agreements are negotiated through many different state players. The U.S. has long held to have more military powers than other kinds of states, and they've long fought for certain kinds of exceptions to clauses. And because tear gases, and I'm going to lump pepper sprays under there for now. So when I say tear gas, I'm referring to what could be OC, PAVA, CS, or CN. The history is very much also about U.S. military power and the U.S. Wanting to be able to transfer these technologies from military use to civilian use. And so I think we have to also understand the political history in order to understand the kind of policy history.
Okay, so that's the story I want you to walk us through here and help us understand. So how far back in history should we go? Where does the story really meaningfully start?
I think the story meaningfully starts in World War I. We know that there's a little bit of experimentation by French police prior to this, but the first time that we really see mass use and mass development is during the First World War. The French are thought to have fired it first, which makes sense if they were experimenting with it, followed by the Germans, and then we had the expansion, including the United States becoming a major manufacturer of all kinds of chemical weaponry during the First World War. In fact, 10% of all chemists in the U.S. were enlisted into war services during that time. And so when the war ended, there were all of these chemical weapons that had been created for wartime that now had no practical use. And so that's a big blow, both for research and development, as well as for the potential commercial market. And so a man named General Amos Fries, who came to take over the Chemical Warfare Service in the U.S., decided amongst some friends that it would be a fantastic idea to start a commercial market for tear gases, among other chemicals. And he worked closely with publicists, with lawyers, to create a demand for, you know, what was essentially a new product, and did these big demonstrations to law enforcement officials, showing what was possible with these weapons. They took out trade magazine advertisements. They did all the kinds of things that you would think of that any new technology would do when it launched a big a big PR campaign.
You write that in your book, you write about how they went to law enforcement departments, to police departments, to kind of do demonstrations or displays.
Yes. So they would, there's this wonderful story covered in the New York Times where they brought a bunch of law enforcement officers out and they had a few of them tear gas the others. And then the journalist describes how, very similar to the story we just heard at the start of this program, you know, the journalist describes the kind of screaming, crying, large men turned into crying babies, you know, of this scene. And then, so the immediate demonstration would get that police department to buy it. The people invited would then want to buy it. And then these news stories would then further amplify the sort of advertisements for these goods.
And so then soon after law enforcement agencies, I guess, began buying it, there's historical evidence that they used it against protesters in the 1930s. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. So this is a time, I think, also importantly, when we're trying to make sense of right now, this was a time of workers' rights movements. It's just around the time of the Great Depression. So we have a lot of political unrest that is, you know, founded on some pretty structural injustices. And this is where we saw the first widespread use of tear gas as a law enforcement technology in the United States. And simultaneously to this, it was being used to suppress colonial uprisings abroad, both by the United States as well as by European countries.
Hmm. Now, what's the seems like there's a really interesting story around one of the biggest examples of the use of this, the Bonus Army March of 1932. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so in 1932, a group of veterans marched from all over the United States to Washington, D.C. to demand this money that they had been promised for fighting in the First World War. And you have to remember, there's mass unemployment at this time. You know, people are starving. They've been kicked out of their homes. And there's a crisis. And people had been promised some assistance. And so they went there to demand the assistance. They set up this protest camp complete with city streets. They had elected officials. And it was a relatively peaceful kind of demonstration. And this was met with kind of full force, tear gas, bayonets out, completely sort of demolishing both the actual physical location of the protest as well as the spirit of the protest, which is also a really important part of thinking about what tear gases do.
Mm. And why? Tell me more about that.
So tear gas was always developed and designed to be both physically tormenting as well as psychologically tormenting. It was described as breaking the mob spirit, of turning collectives into crying, disheveled messes. And so there was always this idea that you would break down that collective spirit that is so essential to the rights to free speech and assembly. And there was also a sense that you could use this to win the media frame. So by showing protesters having to scream and run in different directions and crying and in these clouds of smoke, it all of a sudden turns what would be a calm gathering demanding rights into something that looks like a riot, into something that looks like it needs the force of law enforcement to contain it, to make it safe.
And is that how it was spun in the 1930s?
Yes. And the most fascinating thing about looking at the archival materials from that time is that there is no attempt to hide this. There are literally ads with giant clouds of smoke, people choking, and headlines like "Run screaming from the torturous toxic cloud."
Wow. And so are you seeing similarities then 70 years later?
Yeah, I think it's really important that the moments in which we see a sort of widespread, aggressive, and what I describe as a punitive use, so being used to actually punish protesters of tear gases and as well as impact munitions, these are moments in U.S. history where there is mass civil unrest and calls for structural change and a very authoritative kind of leadership. So we saw that in the 1930s. Then we saw that again in the civil rights era and the Vietnam War protests in the 60s. And then this is, I think, a similar to the kind of moment that we're in right now.
Hmm. Now, of course, we started off with the Lafayette Square protest, in which I think there is a mountain of evidence to show that police actively pushed back protesters using tear gas. In fact, and not just tear gas, but you heard reports of flashbang devices and rubber-coated bullets, et cetera. There was multiple different methods used by multiple law enforcement agencies on that group in order to clear the square area for the president to walk to his photo op. In other cities, however, I think while tear gas was used, for sure, it's possibly a little less clear, and it might get back to what you were saying earlier about the justification around using it if it's not an offensive use but rather a defensive use by law enforcement. So do you see that gray area playing out here now in the protests we've seen recently?
Yeah, see, there's been so many deployments, yeah, right, across, yeah. I can't remember exactly what was in the New York Times story, but over 90 different cities. And each of those uses are going to be somewhat different. According to police own protocol, they should only be using it defensively. They should only be using it with a verbal warning. They should only be using it if there's actual, like, threat of physical harm. And they should only be using certain quantities of it, and only certain people should be allowed to fire it. And so there's all of these rules that guide police department behavior. And some police departments are probably following those protocols, but many, in particularly in the images that then circulate as potentially excessive use of, you know, many are not following those protocols.
Hmm. Well, you know, there are law enforcement experts out there who say that it wouldn't be a wise decision to ban or limit law enforcement's ability to use tear gas in protest or quote-unquote riot control situations because it is a non-lethal tool. And taking away that tool would make it harder to control groups. I mean, we even have a listener here on Facebook, Donnie Thau, who says efforts are mounting to ban rubber bullets as well. Pretty soon, police will just have to ask nicely while being assaulted and having projectiles thrown at them. You know, what is your take, Professor Feigenbaum, on sort of law enforcement saying this is actually an important tool for us in dangerous protest situations?
I think it distracts from what's really at stake here. And that is that at the point at which we have the kinds of protests that we're seeing here, we have had repeated demands for change not being met and being ignored. So what we have to understand about tear gas is that it was actually invented and sold in order to make it easier for people in positions of power to quell protesters' demands and to quell sympathy for protesters. So we have to understand that this is a technology that was made in order to make it harder for people to demand for rights, for equality, for basic kinds of justice. And if we don't see that, and we only make this about should the police have these weapons or those weapons, we lose what's actually at stake in understanding democracy and how it should function.
So a lot of people are wondering also, we talked about the Chemical Weapons Convention from the 90s, but they're wondering how the Geneva Protocols folds in here from, you know, 70 years earlier.
Yeah, so I am not a policy expert, okay, but the current Chemical Weapons Convention is the kind of modern version of these previous treaties. So it, to my knowledge, does not necessarily... It makes sense in terms of having a historical understanding, but what we would be dealing at with what is the internet closest thing we have to treaty law right now, it would be the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Okay. So tell me then, we're talking here about the U.S. context, domestic context versus the international battlefield. Do we see tear gas being used domestically in other countries?
Yes. Yeah, so tear gas is a widely turned to policing technology, and that has to do with the fact that it is thought to be something that you can deploy quickly, that you can get hit a lot of people at once. It's relatively cheap in terms of law enforcement equipment. And it is very good for low accountability because it's very difficult if someone gets injured to know who fired it. Where it came from. And so there's all kinds of kind of strategic reasons why tear gas is a sort of go-to for suppressing protest. Huh.
And so when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the fact that now it seems as if municipalities and even some states are considering banning tear gas. Do you see this as a marked change in terms of the perception of its or the acceptability of its use in the United States?
I have never witnessed en masse as many moves to try and change the situation as we are seeing right now.
Wow. And by the way, as we head into the break, you mentioned an analysis by the New York Times, Professor Feigenbaum. We pulled it up here. The Times found that at least 99 law enforcement agencies, many in large cities, use some form of tear gas against civilians protesting police brutality and racism in recent weeks. So we are talking about the story of tear gas and why it's being allowed to be used domestically by U.S. law enforcement and efforts to change that. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the story of tear gas. It's been around for more than a century. It's banned for use as a weapon of war, and yet at the same time, it's legal for domestic law enforcement to use it here in the United States. So we're trying to understand why. And I'm joined today by Professor Anna Feigenbaum. She's with us from Poole, England. She's author of Tear Gas, From the Battlefields of World War I to the Streets of Today. And Professor, if you can just hang on for a little bit here, I want to now welcome into the conversation Braxton Winston. Braxton joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a member at large in the Charlotte City Council. And last Monday, on June 8th, Charlotte City Council passed a resolution banning the purchase of chemical agents by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department for the next year. Braxton Winston, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
Well, so first of all, you recently wrote in the Washington Post a piece that was headlined, Being Tear Gassed Never Leaves You. So I'm wondering if we could start there. You've been through this experience. Can you tell us that story first?
Well, yes. Well, my story would mirror the story that was told at the top of the hour by Mr. Bosca. It is something, as he said, that shakes one's understanding of what it means to be a citizen. What it does is it uses the tactics of violence, pain, and fear. These are tactics that, of course, are endemic of policing and the overall idea of government's involvement in community safety in America over time. And it uses the punitive controls that we rely on, as Ms. Feigenbaum has said, to try to break down the morale of the crowd. I was tear gassed or exposed to chemical agents for hours and experienced many of those same tactics in 2016, September 20th, 2016. There were flashbangs, concussion grenades, 40 millimeter rounds shot from mortar cannons, stinger grenades, pepper ball rounds, all individually and all at the same time. And they create a trauma in you and in the community that lasts forever, that never leaves. It incites more violence because that is the literal physical reaction that you get. You know, your body convulses, your body starts to quit on yourself. Honestly, it feels like your insides are coming out and your mind kind of gets disjointed from your body. But also there is a certain pointlessness to these things. These tools become unuseful to law enforcement if you resist them. Right. If you do not express that fear, if you do not scatter when those explosions happen, all of a sudden, law enforcement's tool of fear and violence are no longer useful.
Yeah.
And they resort to other tactics, unfortunately.
Well, if I may ask, so in 2016, this happened to you when you you stopped by a protest that was going on in Charlotte over the death of Keith Lamont Scott. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And I just want, because how this happened is also just as important. Professor Feigenbaum has been talking about this as a psychological tool as well. And so there was a gathering of people just outside or just near where Mr. Scott had been shot and killed, and you drove by. I should say shot and killed by police.
Yes, ma'am. This man, Keith Lamont Scott, was waiting for his children to get off the school bus, as he did every day, in his apartment complex. The police were there to serve a warrant in that complex on somebody else. Mr. Scott drew their attention, and within 30 seconds, they had broken out his car window and shot him dead on the floor in front of his wife, who was pleading for them to stop. I was coming home from work, and I this was the summer of 2016, so it was very charged. We had a national political climate that was wild. It was after Ferguson. It was after Trayvon. And I wanted to see some of the things that were happening myself. And I heard the people, the community, decided to take a stand. They wanted to have those policy conversations. They wanted answers now, and they didn't want to talk to the police. They wanted to talk to the mayor, the city council members, anybody who can make changes. And instead of those folks coming up, we were met with police, with riot control agents and riot gear. And they did not want us to be there. So they started to deploy those chemical agents for us to leave. And we resisted that. And that started a week of protests here in Charlotte, where dozens of munitions were put out on peaceful protesters. I sued the city and our police department after that in federal court to try to get an injunction. But again, this is something that has been driving me, and it's a trauma that I live with every day.
Yeah. Now, when you filed that federal lawsuit, the city itself, in response to that, did put a halt on using these using tear gas for a year, and then what happened?
Well, I believe we have not seen that tear gas or those chemical agents being dispersed after that week in 2016 until. Until a couple of weeks ago, about 21 days ago, here in Charlotte, when the first protests and first gatherings started happening here in Charlotte. I went out there again to try to de-escalate certain situations but my police department decided my services weren't welcomed, and they arrested me as I was trying to direct people out of harm's way as they were deploying those chemical agents.
So they might have stopped using it for a year, but they had it and then began using it again, as you just said. So what did the city council do then recently, Mr. Winston?
On June 8th, we were already on it was already on our agenda to adopt our fiscal year budget. And, you know, that prioritizes where our money will be spent. So I added an amendment to that budget, which disallows our police department from using fiscal dollars in the 2021 for using any of that money to acquire new or maintain existing stocks of chemical agents that are used for crowd control and crowd dispersal. We also set up a process that charges the council and the city manager to work at all times to scrutinize and adjust police spending and overall policy implementation, because we know that we cannot change police behavior, tactics, or culture simply by making one motion or changing one policy. We have to take a comprehensive look and make adjustments about how they operate and the tools they use.
But to be clear, just because I don't want there to be any confusion about this, the move by the city council still does not explicitly prevent the Charlotte-Mecklenburg police from using tear gas?
Correct. Again, that was the important part of the second part of the motion, yeah. Is that, you know, stopping them from buying for a year does not do anything about the existing stocks. It does not change the policy of how they operate around crowd control and crowd dispersal. Again, that needs to be a deeper policy discussion. And we know that there are different ways that police departments can acquire things without using fiscal methods, right? Mm-hmm. There's policies that allow police departments, for instance, to trade with other police departments. So if CMPD decides that they have a car or two that they don't want anymore, they can go and trade it to, let's say, Greensboro's police department for, let's say, chemical agents. So again, the most important part I see is the second part, where we are inserting democracy into the policymaking of our police departments. And that is something that hasn't been done here in Charlotte, even though we've always had the political ability to do so.
Well, Professor Feigenbaum, you've been listening patiently, and I'm grateful for that. Do you want to just respond to some of the things you've been hearing Braxton Winston say?
Yeah, it's a fascinating and obviously troubling story, but one that's also all too common, both in contemporary times as well as throughout history. And I think it really magnifies a lot of the origin story of tear gas and what they're used, what they were originally sold to the police and to government officials as being capable of doing. And I think that this move that we're seeing across the United States and elsewhere to really look at the supply chains, to look at budget lines, to look at this issue of funding and police funding is absolutely crucial, because this becomes very clear when we look at the history of all of these riot control products. This is an industry. This is completely a for-profit industry. And if we think about the fact that demand for these products is actually created, it's manufactured. And so we need to be able to have these interventions at this economic level, as well as at that deeper political level around rethinking the democratic structures of our institutions.
And Braxton Winston, your response to that?
I think, you know, Ms. Feigenbaum is absolutely right. You know, what we did also on June 8th is we used our council manager form of government usually is hands off by the elected officials. We say we hire professionals but that's how you get inflated budgets. You know, 40% of our general fund budget goes to the police department, and it's simply because police chiefs have said, we need this to keep people safe. Even though people have been saying, you know, we want to go a different route, we have been hands off. So we have to be willing to roll up our sleeves and do the hard work of really scrutinizing the tactics and tools that are used. For instance, I think if you see in a lot of these protests, police officers are what amplifies the tension. So what if, just as it was on September 20th, 2016 on Old Concord Road, we didn't want to talk to police. We wanted to talk to elected officials. So if we were able to talk to those folks, that would have de-escalated the situation. We have to put de-escalation at the core of our government interactions with our people. And if it's at the core, it never leaves. And if it never leaves, there is no place for chemical agents on anybody at any point of time.
Yeah, on your point of de-escalation here, we've got an interesting comment that's come in from Jeffrey D'Aruda. And Jeffrey, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your last name here, but Jeffrey says, tear gas is awful. He says, quote, I've been through basic in the Army. We all got gassed. However, that was also in a controlled environment, and we knew it was coming. The potential to create a human stampede when used on crowds of civilians is not a joke. People can die. Then he goes on to say, there are better ways to do crowd control, most of which involve engaging in a dialogue about the movement in question before danger of riot even gets close. The use of tear gas represents a fundamental failure on the part of our leaders to actually lead. That's an online comment that we got there. Professor Feigenbaum, so we've been hearing what's been happening there in Charlotte, North Carolina. I just wanted to list out some of the places just in the past couple of weeks that have also either had calls for banning tear gas or have actually made moves to do so. I mean, in Massachusetts, the chairs of the House and Senate committees on public health there are calling for a ban on tear gas across the state. In Denver, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order banning the Denver police from using it. In Seattle, the mayor there said a ban on CS gas would continue for 30 days. We've got Portland, Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Columbus, Ohio. So it's a pretty steady drip of places across the country, as we were saying earlier, that we haven't necessarily seen before. Do you think that this actually could be a turning point, or for as long as we have basically legally written into the conventions that we were talking about before, that tear gas is likely to stay as part of the picture of law enforcement in the United States for some time?
I think like any campaign, we need to be going about it on multiple fronts. What we definitely have now is much better public education, much better public discussion like this on the issues. We need our policy experts and international policy to be going after these exceptions to the clause, and the details are in that exception that allow it to be maintained. We need to show that the real life deployment of these riot control agents does not match the ways that the policy was written. On a national level, we need to see legislation that works across all law enforcement agencies. It's fantastic to see on these city levels and county levels, people demanding a different way of doing budgets, people saying this is not where funding should be going to guarantee community safety. And I think we also, as we are starting to see, need campaigning economic forms of campaigning in the form of boycotts. So right now we have two campaigns, one called Boycott BD and another called Dump the Diamond, that are calling on a mountain equipment, climbing equipment supplier to drop its ties with Safariland and Claris, which is owned by Warren Kanders, who recently resigned from the Whitney Museum because of his ties to this riot control equipment, including those Sting Ball grenades that opened the show.
Huh. Now, Braxton Winston, let me ask you physically, how are you doing? Do you have lingering effects from being tear gassed in 2016?
Oh, well, I had some bruises from those 40 millimeter rounds that honestly stuck with me for about a year. But really, it's the mental and psychological effects. When you, as Mr. Bosca said, it shakes your understanding of what it means to be a citizen, that my government would use the most violent tactics on me as I express my First Amendment rights. And I would be breaking no other law. They were just grew impatient with me and did not want me to be there. So they told me to go home. That is something that never leaves you. I was triggering when I was hearing that report. And it takes me back there all the time. I could not hold my children for a week because it was covered. I have long locks and it was soaked into my hair. It hurt when I would take a shower for a week. Chemical agents should not be used on any person anywhere in this world.
Well, Braxton Winston is a member at large for the Charlotte City Council. We have a link to his Washington Post opinion piece. That link is at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Anna Feigenbaum, associate professor in communications and digital media at Bournemouth University's Talbot campus in southern England, and author of Tear Gas, From the Battlefields of World War I to the Streets of Today. Professor Feigenbaum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Bye.